Hi, I'm Shannon, and this week on C-SPAN's Afterwards podcast, New School economic professor Teresa Ghilarducci offers her thoughts on how to make retirement in the U.S. attainable for more Americans. She's interviewed by Washington Post economics correspondent Abba Baturbay.
Since March 19, 1979, C-SPAN, a public service funded by the cable television industry, began giving you direct access to government in an innovative way by putting you, the viewer, into the rooms where politics is debated and policies are determined. C-SPAN began as a bold initiative. Now, 45 years later, we are essential for those wanting to see democracy at work, without editing or commentary. With continued cable support, we've done this without a dime of government funding, maintaining our independence. As we mark 45 years, the business of media is rapidly changing, and now your support is crucial for our mission's future. Support our legacy of unfiltered access by donating today at cspan.org/donate. Thank you.
Dr. Teresa Ghilarducci, I am so honored to be here with you today to talk about this very important issue that affects all of us. Whether you're old, young, you know, going to retire one day or already retired, this is a very important issue, and I am just so delighted to talk with you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for bringing me in to talk about the issue that, like you said, affects young people now going into the labor market. People in this liminal period of like 55 to 65, you have one foot in, one foot out, your mind is like going forward, and then the people who are already retired, and I found that many of them are actually re-entering the labor force. So it's like work, retire, and repeat, you know, is the cycle that I've identified, and that, you know, landed as the title of the book.
Absolutely. So in your book, Work, Retire, Repeat, you write about how retirement inequality has gotten worse. We've ended up with a system that's widely polarized. And before we go into the reasons for that, can you lay the groundwork for us? What are the two realities when it comes to retirement today? And give us examples of each one.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you, sounds like you did a close reading of the book, is that the theme of it is kind of what I call the tale of two retirements. Of course, there's a tale of, you know, 70 million, you know, retirements because, you know, there are now 70 million people about who are retired, another 72 that will be retired in the next, you know, 10 years. But I really saw distinct patterns. And it was patterns of retirement into comfort or in just having enough. You know, I'm not for a public policy that makes every retiree rich, you know, or give advice that lets a worker, you know, retire with plenty. I think the goal, the sensible goals of any nation, any modern economy, is that people work their careers, their lives, maybe 35 years for some careers, maybe 45 years for other careers. Every kinds of demands of jobs are different. But that when you are finished with that, that you can live a reasonable amount of time in retirement at the same standard of living with which you experienced, except if you're very poor, you shouldn't also be working poor and then retired poor. We should do something for the bottom. So that's my vision, my framework, and that period of time should be dignified. But what I've found is that inequality of wealth and health are really dividing people, so that the people who won't live as long as people who have gotten good health care, have had jobs that haven't, you know, didn't break down their bodies, and who may be lucky enough or have the education enough that their employers want them around in their 60s, that they are retiring with health and wealth. And they're even getting the benefits of longevity. You know, the longevity gains have really gone to the top half of the income distribution, and a little more to even the top half of that top half. But the bottom of the income distribution are really not experiencing the longevity gains as everybody else. Their health going into retirement is worse. And their jobs for older people, this is what's really shocked me, hasn't been aided by technology or the use of the computer. The computer and technology has actually made some people's jobs in old age worse. So there's more stooping and bending. There's more heavy lifting than there was for people in their 50s than there was even 40 years ago. And there's also more demand for keen concentration and really good eyesight. So it seems as though the computer has been used to kind of speed up work and to intensify work. And so work is not easier for people involved in physical or routine, what we call routine jobs. And those kinds of jobs, especially because they're usually subordinate, that you usually are taking orders from a boss and increasingly orders from a computer, really break down older bodies. So you asked me about the tale of two retirements. There's a lot of complexity, but I really see two streams. People who have not had the ability to acquire wealth so they can leave their low reward jobs. And I see a lot of people who are cruising into their old age with, you know, complex choices about, do I work a few more hours in my law jobs or cut back, and what do I do with all my money? It's clearly, that's a problem, but it's not a social problem. And I feel that policymakers and policies have not recognized this duality, and they're not taking into account, not even the bottom half, it's really, for a lot of problems, it's the bottom 90%. They're not taking into account their house, their home insecurity, their health insecurity, and their wealth and income insecurity. That was a long answer, I'm sorry.
No, that's great. One of the things that really struck me in your book is this idea that working longer into your 70s is this option that's presented as a win-win a lot of times. Yeah. You know, it's great for the older people who are working. It's keeping their minds healthy. Yeah. They're staying in the labor force. It's good for the economy. But you make the point that that's not the case. There is a very specific loser here, and that in most cases is the older worker. Can you talk a bit more about that?
Yeah. So, I mean, my book is, you know, structured to talk about, you know, briefly, it's only two chapters, the problem. What is the retirement crisis? How do we know we have one? And what we would have to not have one. You know, so it's the problem. And then there's a bit that reprises my other work about the causes of that problem, basically the disappearance of pensions and the decline of Social Security. Excuse me. and so we have the problem, we have the causes, and then we have the fake solution, you know, to that problem. And that's the working longer, what I call the working longer consensus. So I really spent a lot of time in my book to talk about why it's a fake solution. And expecting people, pushing people, being comforted by the fact that people can just work longer and take care of their financial problems in old age is not realistic. And it also is harmful. And it's harmful to the older body and to the older person. It's harmful to younger workers. And it might even be harmful in terms of our economy. I'm an economist, sorry, but I care a lot about productivity. It could be actually harmful for our innovation and our productivity. But you just asked me, why is it harmful to older bodies? Because you have elite economists, you know, and policymakers saying, my job, you know, in my 60s and 70s is really rewarding. You know, it keeps my mind fresh. I'm involved in matters of importance, and therefore I'm important. And I do not deny that. There are some jobs where if you can control the pace and the content of that job, it does keep your mind alive. And you also get to control other people, and that actually gives you a sense of hierarchy and being on top of the hierarchy. These are basic human needs, the human need to have resources and to control the pace and content of your life. And it's very unfortunate that the people who make policy or who do work on this area are people with those rare jobs that you can do in old age. And what I wanted to do is to lift up all the other people that don't have control over the pace and content of their work and who have other interests and who want to spend time with their friends, their family, to actually stop their bad habits, to pay attention to their health. And so I spent the most time on those that part of the book where I reviewed hundreds and hundreds, it's called a meta-analysis, of research from psychology, from gerontology, from medical journals, and also all over the world, but mostly Western Europe and the United States, and came to the conclusion, I'm really proud of that section of the book, that, and this is the conclusion, that people who have had low reward to effort jobs, kind of their whole life, that's kind of the life cycle, where it means that you're required to maybe learn new technologies, take care of more people. I'm thinking of people in the caring industries. Take on more physical and mental burdens because of the computer, and the pay has just not kept up. And you know, my life is an economist, and I've followed whether or not pay has kept up with the productivity of most workers. And we all kind of agree that there's this alligator graph of high productivity and kind of low wage growth. So there's been a big gap in the United States between how much is expected of workers and how much they've gotten. That actually is proof that most jobs are low reward and falling, reward to effort ratio. Okay, so that's the kind of the little math, and that's the graph. If you've been in those kinds of jobs your whole life, then working longer raises cortisol levels. It actually can cause some muscular and skeletal pressures on knees, on joints, on your immune system, and on your other systems that control diabetes and heart disease and other kinds of organ health. I mean, it got really nitty gritty, but the conclusion was that retirement is very beneficial for huge parts of the population. I would say for 90% of the population, knowing that you're going to be able to retire, knowing that you're going to be able to retire healthy, knowing that you'll have the resources like your house and a little bit of money to create what psychologists call a personal narrative of your life is, I get a little bit of, this is the emotional part of the book, it becomes the very essence of what it means to be a human being is to be able to have that life cycle. And we've had times in our economy where the economy has gotten richer and more people, like, you know, besides the rich, could look forward to that time of the creation of their personal narrative. But we're slipping backwards and we're taking that away from people.
What proportion of America today has that luxury of being able to prepare for their own retirement and rely on it?
Yeah, so so this book, this is one of a series of books I've written over the past 40 years, summarizes that that answer. You asked me who really has enough money to retire and maintain their living standards and to avoid poverty. And it's about 15%. It's only 15%. And I've spent the other books redoing those numbers, interrogating those numbers, stress testing those numbers, really defining enough, you know, at very low amounts. Okay, you're 125% of poverty. Okay, you're 150% of poverty. Because I didn't want anybody to criticize me for overstating the retirement problem. But the wealth creating mechanisms in our society. Just think of them, the past 40 years. They were supposed to be home equity building. We have a really robust mortgage market. We have what other countries don't have. We have something called a 15-year mortgage and a 30-year mortgage. I mean, people could get a mortgage at a fixed rate, you know, for 30 years. You can't get that in other countries. I mean, so that was supposed to be not only a way to build neighborhoods and to get people security in their lives, but it was supposed to build wealth. So that was a wealth-building institution. And then we had this big retirement account-building institutions. We have huge tax breaks. It's like, you know, $250 billion a year shoved towards people to incent them to save. and to incent their employers to save for them. So we have the 401k industry, you know, has and all the other types of accounts that look like 401ks that was supposed to build wealth for the past 40 years. And lo and behold, when we look at what happened over the past 40 years, those wealth building institutions were overwhelmed by the debt creating institutions. And so you asked me, okay, where did we land after Social Security was cut because the retirement age has increased over the past 40 years? That started in the Reagan era cuts of Social Security. Where did we land when around that time we also had policies that crushed the defined benefit of the traditional pension plan? Those policies were a bit indirect. They were policies that were kind of anti-union, and unions were a wealth-creating institution. Unions actually helped workers and their employers build wealth for retirement, and that got suppressed and in some places crushed. So over that 40 years, we've run this experiment, and we've landed to a situation where the poverty rate for elders are now 1 out of 4, if we use international standards for poverty, which are the better standards than our American standards. And we also have landed in a place where the next generation will be worse off than even their parents' generation. And so that experiment just didn't work. It relied on employers volunteering to have a retirement plan. Well, it turns out a lot of employers have a lot of stresses and strains of their own, and they prefer not to provide a pension plan if they can get away with it. And so that half of the workforce, and I'm going to kind of land on this number because it always surprises people and it surprises me, half of the workforce at any one point in time do not have a way to save for their retirement at work. And more people get their wealth from work. And so we've just left behind half of the workforce at any one point in time. Now, by the time they're 60, more than half have some retirement accounts, but they really don't add up to much. The bottom 50% of people at the time of retirement have nothing. The next 40% have about $100,000 in their retirement account. When the stock market goes up, that goes up to maybe, you know, $200,000, so from $100,000 to $200,000. And then the top 10%, you know, have close to $800,000, $900,000 to $1 million. You know, the kind of tranche that way, and the numbers change whenever the stock market changes. But it's in that area. That means nobody has enough to supplement Social Security on average, a typical person, to maintain their lifestyle. It's not a public policy problem, what the top 10%, but it is a public policy problem by what happens to the bottom 90%. It doesn't just affect the old person too, it affects their families. We're seeing a big burden on the sandwich generation. Women and men, sons and sons-in-law and daughters-in-law in their 50s, a good chunk of them are having to spend down their own retirement assets and take up their own time from work in order to take care of their, you know, financially fragile elders. And that's just creating another generation of fragility.
That's a really important point. And that's something that you say in the book, too, that there are ripple effects beyond just this one generation of older workers that's in retirement today. Yeah. I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about the pandemic. Early on in the book, you mentioned that, you know, it really exposed a lot of vulnerabilities in the system. We saw so many workers get forced into retirement, perhaps earlier than they wanted to. And for some of them, maybe it was a blessing if they had the financial means. But for many more, it was this very desperate situation made even more dire. And I'm wondering if you could expand on that a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, 4 years later, what do things look like?
Yeah, that's where actually the tale of two retirements became the only way to describe all this data that was coming in, the people who were fortunate enough to work from home, and they had enough kind of skills and status at their work The pandemic might have been a blessing. They loved it. They kept their jobs, and they also could do their laundry, you know, while they were doing their jobs. I mean, I remember thinking, that's great. I could teach from home. It didn't work because teaching is bad, but I could do my research from home, and I got more to eat during the day. It was really great. But that was very few of us. That was maybe 10-15% of us who could have stayed home. And we also got our vaccines. We had enough space. We were healthy enough, and the immune systems high enough. We didn't have to, and we didn't live in dense housing, you know, so that staying home didn't mean that we were having to live with people who had to go out. To the other group, you know, the bottom 90%, and especially with people who didn't have college educations, they had jobs where most of that job could not be done at home. And if they could, they were in much, you know, more dense housing. And their employers were kind of eager to push them out. So all of a sudden, we saw the unemployment rates of older workers exceed that of younger workers. And that doesn't happen. I mean, I'm a labor economist. I have these kind of rules of thumbs about what's supposed to happen. And we usually see the unemployment rates of older people, more experienced people, people more attached to the labor force, you know, more protected, you know, during recessions. And this one went all kaflooey. And I characterized it as kind of a once-in-a-lifetime chance for employers to push out their older workers. It was during the Trump administration, and the Trump administration was not famous for its protection of worker rights. So there was not a lot of protection against discrimination, age discrimination. So we saw a real bifurcation of people in their late 50s being pushed out of their jobs much sooner than they had expected. And we're going to follow those people, because when you're pushed out of your job much sooner than you expect, then you have to draw down those savings. And perhaps you were expecting to build those up for another 5 years. You have to collect Social Security at age 62, whereas you had been expecting it to wait till 65, or take the advice to wait all the way up to 70, because the difference in monthly benefit between 62 and 70 is about 35%. So that, you know, would have meant that if you retired at 70, or at least claimed at 70, and stop me if I'm going into too much detail, but this is really important for everybody to know what the financial tricks are. If you can wait till 70, you get the best financial instrument in the world, because you have received an 8% increase in your monthly income. If you wait from 62 to 70, it's 6% or 8%, just exactly where you decide to delay your claiming. You get 6 to 8%. It's guaranteed by the U.S. Government, and it's indexed to inflation, and it will last the rest of your life. Nobody on the planet has such a good deal. But it turns out only about 7 or 8% of us can wait that long. So you're pushed out at 55 because of the pandemic or because of any severe recession. You draw down your savings and you collect that much reduced Social Security benefit at 62. And you're cruising for poverty or near poverty for the rest of your life. Or if you can, you hop back into the labor market and you get a job as an Uber driver. You get a job at an Amazon warehouse during these heavy, you know, seasonal times. And you become like those people in No Man's Land, the Academy Award-winning movie. Those people were older, and they suffered from the recession in 2008. You know, because I know that. I worked with the author of the book that became the movie. Those were victims of early retirement, you know, in a financial crisis. Also, one of the insidious things about our 401k system, it's insidious because it really benefits the most privileged in our society. If you can think about it, on paper, everybody should be able to save 5% of their income when they start work at 25, keep it in the market, you know, in a patient, you know, responsible way, have a diverse portfolio, maybe 50% stocks or maybe a little more, 50% bonds. You keep it in your accounts, you know, for 40 years, and voila, it yields, you know, $500,000 that you can attach to your Social Security benefit. And then you can decide if your job is, you know, satisfactory or not, and then you can tweak around your retirement age. On paper, the individual drives the entire deal. You know, it looks fantastic. You're there at your keyboard calculating this, and you are in complete control. But real life doesn't work that way, and either does the economy. But some people get to have those charmed lives. They're highly educated. They have jobs that are fairly secure. They've never suffered a period of unemployment or withdrawal from the labor market to care for somebody. And they've never had to take money out of their accounts in order to weather life's, you know, vagaries, through our own choice, through the choice of our kinship networks, our family members, or the economy. And so you have, at the end of that 40-year experience, 10-15% of people who were able to act like a spreadsheet, like an Excel spreadsheet, but everybody else tried to build up their wealth. They had a job, they were getting raises, and they were building up their wealth. They were buying stocks as it accumulated in value, and then poof, the recession happened and their hours were cut back, or they had to take money out of their 401k just when the stock market's declining. They may even be one of the few that lost their job, you know, for 6 months or so. The stock market is at its bottom, because that's what economies do, but you don't get to buy it at the low. Okay, you wait around, you get your job, you have a year to get back into the market. Your wages, you know, are keeping up, and then you're back in the market again at the high point. Then you have suffer another cycle, and you're selling when the prices are falling. Now that seems like kind of wonky in detail, but that adds up. And so you have people who've had these kinds of, who have been in these unstable industries that kind of have these ebbs and flow, have really wonky looking wealth. They have different kinds of 401ks. It wasn't managed over a long period of time. They used it for emergency savings. And so it's absolutely no wonder that with that kind of patchy system, and where employers sometimes stop contributing. During the pandemic, my own employer stopped contributing to my pension plan. So I lost out. Oh, I'm mad, you know, but I'm okay. But I lost out on that buildup in the market, you know, for that 2020 and 2021. So that's what the system that we built, and it really has created where we landed, you know, which is that most people don't have enough money to maintain their standard of living into retirement.
I want to talk a bit more about Social Security.
Yeah.
This is a program that was created almost 100 years ago in the 1930s.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I'd like you to tell us a bit about what it was first envisioned as, and then also what happened in the early 1980s. What sort of cuts did we see then, and how has that affected the picture of retirement down the line?
Yeah, and so I'll probably tell you a story about Social Security. It's a little bit different than you've heard before. It was a system that was late in coming. Most other countries, you know, had a Social Security system in the teens and the 20s. And so the actuaries and the politicians that built the system were really using a tried and true model from Europe. And this was a model of insurance, not welfare, not a handout, but it was a model of social insurance. And therefore, actuaries were involved in the very beginning of the system. And actuaries are cool because they take in information now and they project out into the future. They take information about immigration, workforce participation, how well those workers will be paid, you know, how productive the economy will be. They take into account patterns of fertility, how many babies people are going to have and how many of those babies will grow up into workers. And then they take into account all the medical information about how long people will be able to live. So they have all that in hand. It was an actuarial-based social insurance system. And that started in 1935, and it was funded by current workers paying into the system And that money was put into a trust fund and used to pay the benefits of people who had already worked. So it was an intergenerational transfer based on insurance. But the cool part about the government doing that is that produced a huge demand for the private sector. It produced a huge demand for a complementary system. And we expected that because social scientists and economists and actuaries were involved in building the system, that all of a sudden the workforce would say, hey, there's a basis of support. I want to add to that through my workplace. And so we had tons of unions coming in right after, during the war and after the war, building on the Social Security system. So the Social Security system is a base of support, but it was never meant to be the only support because it expected all the economic institutions would come on top of that. And low-income workers, like in the construction industry, the garment worker, the department store and restaurant workers were organized at that time. They built pension systems on top of that Social Security system. And we also knew that the private economy would grow, it'd be very productive, and it was. That means the bonds and the stocks that were based on that economy would help go back into those pensions. So what I loved about that system when I first became an economist is that the workers' productivity would come back to fund their retirement. It seemed like a stable system, kind of a system of harmony, both sociologically, psychologically, and economically. And in that hybrid model, that kind of layered system, Social Security on the bottom and that private savings in the middle, seemed to be a stable system that rewarded people that needed to be rewarded and also gave people, because my mother was working class and my father, you know, died without being able to retire, that it gave kind of people like my parents, you know, something to look forward to. And I'm very sorry to say that over the 40 years or 35 years that I've been researching, that dream of what Social Security could be the auger for, you know, the kind of the protein base for, it just didn't work, it fell apart. So we can talk more about Social Security, how that base is doing and what we could do to shore it up. But the real culprit in the retirement crisis is that middle tier, that tier on top of that, that never fulfilled its potential.
We've been talking a lot about what retirement looks like in the United States, but I'm wondering if you can tell us a bit about the picture in other advanced countries.
Yeah.
What do things look like in Japan or Italy, Germany, Canada? You know, what can we learn from them?
Yeah, it's really a great question because Social Security was based on examples from other countries, and other countries actually look to America. We're not an insular system. We have very similar market-based, capitalist, democratic nations. And so the world is kind of an experiment, and we want to learn what the best practices are in each of these countries. And America is falling way behind in designing our systems to include the best practices in other countries. Now, other countries have, you know, there's as different systems as there are countries, but there's some basic design elements that they have that we don't have. And most of those countries look to the United States to say, wow, that's weird. So the one design element that all the other countries have that we don't have is that when they give tax breaks for retirement savings, that retirement savings is meant to stay long-term in the market. There's no way in other countries that you can take money out to redo your kitchen, you know, to weather an unemployment, whatever we define as an emergency. There's no way that you can drain that money, just like we can't drain our Social Security in order to pay for life's, you know, emergencies. In those countries, they have emergency savings and then they have retirement savings. But in our country, we have design elements where we use our retirement really as emergency savings. In fact, you may have had that experience where you go to an employer and they say, hey, you can sign up for a 401k if you're one of the lucky ones that have a 401k at work. and they say, hey, sign up now. The employer will match it a little bit, but if you ever need it, you can take it out. Nice conversation to have for a, you know, kind of a young worker or a worker who doesn't know what their finances, really bad policy. So other countries don't allow leakage. And that means other countries have much better wealth portfolios for their workers. If you're saving long-term, you have a much more diversified portfolio that can take on a little more risk. And you, if it's pooled, you could also demand lower fees from the financial institutions that are investing your money. And most other countries have these pooled aspects. The 401k is not pooled. By design, it's an individual account, and the individual decides how it's invested. It's a little bit like asking Americans to pull their own teeth or do their own electricity. I mean, this is very important professional work, and it's the only area where we sort of demand the individual who isn't an expert to do that work. I spent a lot of time talking about the mistakes that PhD economists make in designing our own portfolio. I don't want it. I want a professional to do it. So that's our big mistake. The other big mistake we make when we look at Canada, even the UK, Australia, you know, that's kind of our Anglo-American type system, is that they have universal coverage. You know, they can't say, ooh, at any one point in time, half of our workforce doesn't have that second tier of support. And we've gone half that way. Everybody who works has Social Security. But the other countries have said, okay, we're going to provide a Social Security type system. And on top of that, we are going to require an advance funded, you know, individual accounts. And we didn't do that. So our other big design problem is that we don't get people into the system. We don't have a wealth building institution for, you know, half the workforce. And then the other design problem, there's only three. I mean, healthcare is a lot more, that would be a lot longer book. It'd be a lot longer conversation. The other thing you're supposed to have in your pension system is a way to draw it out so it lasts your lifetime. It's really a modest goal. I retire either because I'm pushed out, and most people are pushed out of their jobs. I didn't say that, but this whole fantasy that we can decide when to work, you know, or to jump back in the labor force isn't just our choice, it's our employer's choice. And most people who are retired say, I had to retire a lot sooner than I expected. Well, when that point comes, you want to make sure that your $200,000 or your $500,000 or maybe even your $2 million will last your lifetime, and nobody knows when they're going to die. And so other countries have a way, in a fair way, a group annuities to have a lifetime benefit. And the past 40 years, we designed a system that doesn't have that problem. So even if you were lucky enough to accumulate $500,000 into your retirement account, you're left at age 65 not knowing what the heck to do with it. But other people have other designs on your money. So we have five times the predators, financial predators, on older people than other countries. That's another aspect of our system that is not lifted up. I do mention it in my book, is that our system has built a system where we have older people, if they're lucky, have piles of cash they have to manage, and they're being inundated by financial predators. And so we have to have a whole other layer of protection on that. It's as if we have a system where we put $10,000 bills tied to a lapel, you know, of an older person, and said, okay, now go on the bus, here's a pamphlet of financial education about how to handle that, but you're on your own. We've also produced a system that other countries don't have of shame. Because if you don't have enough money and you're in a do-it-yourself system, it must have been your fault. If you don't manage that money, it must have been your fault. If someone said that, hey, you have to pay your Amazon account, so give me your credit card number, or I'm your grandson and I'm in a train station, I need, you know, $10,000, and you fall for that, you're deeply ashamed. And so the landscape in America, and not other countries, are filled with, you know, mothers and, you know, grandmas who are not telling their family members that they were duped. And we only find that out when they move in with their kin or their you know, terribly desperate. So we've produced a system unlike our other countries. Yeah, we got the Social Security system right. We have that social insurance. But that tier was so much built around the individual taking all the risk that their employer wouldn't contribute, that they couldn't contribute, that they didn't know where to invest, that the fees were too high, and that they didn't manage it correctly if they were lucky enough to get past those first two steps. So where does that land us? We have quadruple or double the poverty rates in old age. I testified in the Senate 2 weeks ago, and we spent some time on why America has one out of four retirees poor and other country, and the Netherlands, who actually has a very well-designed system, universal coverage. Unions and employers create individualized kind of pension plans to match the needs of that industry. And they have a really robust regulatory system so the money is well regulated. They have 3% of their elders are poor, and we have 23% of our elders are poor. So a well-designed pension system is what we need. It's what most workers deserve. And there are ways to get that.
Along those lines, I want to talk a bit more about solutions. And you have come up with a proposal you call the Gray New Deal. I'm wondering if you can tell us about that and exactly what we can do to start addressing this problem of retirement.
Well, there's I really spent some time thinking about how to title a whole host of policies that would lift up workers' expectation to retire and also lift up, make more dignified the actuality of old age and retirement. And so I used the word gray. And I'm an American, right? I kind of shrunk from this idea, ooh, gray is not good. And I thought, hell, gray is great. In other countries, you have Danish people in gray hair walking around enjoying museums and golfing and coffee. You know, why can't being gray be a good thing? So I boldly, it's kind of, you know, disruptive way, put gray as the first thing. And then the New Deal refers to boldness. You know, that it actually has to create and it has to solve an urgent problem, just like the old New Deal solved the urgent problem of worldwide depression and actually socialist and communist revolution. You know, that we had socialist candidacies and communist parties growing up in the devastation. So the New Deal was kind of a social, political, and economic program. So here it is, a gray lifted up New Deal, make it bold. And there's a lot of policies, and they're broken up into two sections. And one section is, if old people want to work or even have to work, make those jobs good. You know, really protect those jobs, make employers and the industries and have the government help those industries and employers make those jobs appropriate for older bodies. If someone needs to have more time to recover or need some accommodation on the job, they don't have to be disabled. They just could ask for those accommodations. We see this in other parts of Europe for sure, but in America we work more than other people do. So if that's a reality, then protect those jobs. So I have a whole host. It's actually chapter 9 out of 10 chapters, and they're short. Good jobs for older workers, and I have a whole host of ways to do that. And one of them is to create an older workers bureau in the Department of Labor. And that bureau would collect all the data we need from Social Security, from the Census Department, from the Commerce Department, from the Labor Department, and like look at the landscape of policies, programs, and procedures, and make sure that we have a hospitable infrastructure that allows older people to work in dignity without actually hastening their death and their morbidity, because that's what we have now. We have people stooping and bending who are 68 in Amazon warehouses, and we know from the literature they'll die sooner or be disabled sooner than they otherwise would if they had retired. And then the whole other part of the chapter, of that section, chapter 10, is about what we need to do with Social Security and what we need to do with pensions. And I can just land there. Social Security needs more money. We are past the moment that we were in the 90s and in the 80s, and as recently as the Trump administration, in talking about how to cut benefits and raise revenues. We're past that. People don't have enough. There's no room to cut Social Security. The average benefit is about $1,100 a month now. That hasn't kept up with what people need, so just stop talking about raising cutting benefits. So we need more revenue so that we can pay full benefits starting in 2034, just 10 years from now, 9 years from now. And we need to lift it up, the bottom benefits, so no one's in poverty. That's just a given. That's well-worn territory, lots of ways to do it. What's new in my book and what my career has been about is like fixing that employer-provided private sector tier. We need to have people in pensions accumulating money during their working lives. That money has to be invested well, and that money has to be at least have an option to be paid out in a lifetime benefit in a way that doesn't, put people in high-priced, bad deal individual annuities. So there is a bill in Congress now called the Retirement Security for All Americans Act, and it is what it says: all Americans get to have retirement security. And what it does is provide some incentives for the bottom half of the labor force to save for retirement. It gives them not just a tax deduction, a tax break, meaning that if you earn a lot and you have a high tax rate, you get a big savings out of your taxes. But you actually get money contributed into your account. About $600 for a minimum wage worker would be added to their account every year, and the worker would add money to that account, and that would build up. So they would have about $300,000, $400,000 to add to their Social Security. Now, they're not going to live at golf courses, but they will be able to maybe maintain their house and not depend upon their kids. That's just what we want. So that bill doesn't cost that much because we're just supplementing the savings of low-income workers. That's only about $50 billion a year, $30 to $50 billion a year. Compared to the $250 billion that we already give through the tax code. That's simple. And then everybody's in a pension. And then everybody's also in the stock market. So the Republicans like it. I'm not really that political, actually. I have values, but I'm not a political scientist. But the Republicans seem to like it because they want everybody involved in the capitalist system. And so do workers. Every housekeeper I've met in a hotel wants to have, a fund. They want to be in the stock market. And the Democrats like it because they, for whatever reason, are a party of kind of economic security for most workers. So it's a bipartisan solution, and it really is not crazy. It's not radical. It comports to what Canada's doing and Denmark. I don't have to go to crazy France or Italy to say that we should be like them. Canada is a lot like us, and so is so is the Netherlands. And what it does is that it brings in that act, and that movement says, look, we can't just tweak around the edges and give tax breaks to employers that really don't want a pension plan anyway. That's not going to do it. We've had 40 years of experimentation with little tweaks that really depend upon voluntarism, but depend upon incentives. Just have a kind of what's called a hard, a soft mandate. Everybody is in. There's ways to escape. I don't like that part, but there's ways to escape. Maybe politically that's necessary, but make it universal and then let people invest in a sensible way. And I can go into details about that, but the basic idea is that in a pooled fund with low fees.
In the meantime, while we wait for this legislation to make its way through Congress, what can people do to prepare for their own retirements?
Yeah, I mean, my second to the last book, I'm not going to promote that, but people really like it. It's really small, it costs $10. It's called How to Retire with Enough Money. And I had to arm wrestle with my publisher because my publisher also publishes Susie Orman. and they were used to kind of the hype where everybody could get risk. I said, no, that's not my goal. I want everyone just to have enough, not a plenty. And that little book has the advice and answers the question that you just asked me. What can people do now, waiting for, the Great New Deal? Well, if you're in your 30s, take advantage of time. Society hasn't given you that much in your 30s. You might have had an education, but you paid for it, with your student loans. But you have time, and compound interest is really on your side. Save 5 to 7% somewhere for your retirement. Really, save it and forget about it. It's not your emergency savings, no matter what your employer says that you can have access to it. Don't have access to it. Just put it out of your mind. So save automatically and don't let anybody touch it. Don't let your frantic self touch it. Don't you let your relatives touch it. Don't let your partner touch it to say, ooh, don't you want to buy a house? You could just take money out of your 401k. Don't let the auto dealer touch it because you want that new car. Don't let anybody touch that. And make sure that you invest it well. I promote Vanguard, even though they don't have anything to do with me. They don't give me money to say it. But Vanguard is a really interesting financial institution in America because it's a mutual fund institution, meaning that they have fiduciary duty towards the account holders, unlike all the other money managers. So they have to either give you really good service because you are the shareholder, or they have to lower the fees. And lo and behold, they do both. So Vanguard accounts for 40 years, 5% of your income, coupled with Social Security, and you'll be okay. You'll have enough. So you have to really marshal your power as a worker and a saver and make good choices as an investor. But you also have to marshal your power as a voter, because one of the most important financial partners that any of us will have is the federal government. So you have to really scrutinize politicians' record on what they say about Medicare and Social Security. That's not your voter and political part of your brain. That's your financial management part of your brain. If you're in your 40s and 50s, you have a tougher road ahead because you don't have as much time as that 30-year-old is. Let's say you're 40. You have to up your savings, not from 5%, but 10% and even 15%. So that's going to hurt. You're going to feel it in the decisions you make about your clothes, your house, your car, and your transportation, and even where you live, and even the hours of work. But boost that up 10%. If you're 50 and you're coming into your 50s because you've had a divorce or you've had the kind of job where they didn't contribute, you're an Uber driver, you have to save 25 to 50% of your income to be able to celebrate. You're also in the buzzsaw of age discrimination. You're in the buzzsaw of having aches and pains and a knee surgery. Your age is starting and gravity is starting to kind of show up in your body. But if you don't have anything, and this is the hardest conversation I have, you not only have to work more, save more, but you're going to try to actually resist your employer wanting to push you out. So you may actually have to reskill. It's really tough. But with less consumption, more savings, and a dedication to your work life, you may be able to make it to not just 62, but to 65, where you can get Medicare. And that goes back to public policy. Vote for politicians that will lower the Medicare age to 60 or to 55. Because if you can get health care at 60 and not have to worry about that, you may be able to get, have a work-life balance that isn't just striving to get medical care. And if you don't have a job with medical care, you can be saved from these high Obamacare premiums, and you actually may be able to keep your health up. The other advice I give, and this just comes out of the research, I'm not coming out of the kind of the health and fitness magazines that wag a finger at you. It would be good financial advice to avoid diabetes. That your health then becomes a financial situation, because diabetes doesn't kill you, but it does cost a lot. It costs a lot in all sorts of areas. So part of your investment in your financial future is, you know, what these naggy health and fitness people say, that you got to take care of your health. But it turns out if you're retired, that's actually easier to do. So that question is absolutely the hardest question that I get when I talk about my book, because 50-year-olds and 60-year-olds had to live through what I call this failed experiment with do-it-yourself pensions. And now we're trying to do cleanup. And we should. We should actually help that generation by raising by lowering the Medicare age and boosting Social Security benefits. I mean, that generation that had to live through that experiment, you know, is owed something.
Dr. Ghilarducci, this has been incredible. Before we wrap up, I want to ask you how your personal thoughts on retirement have changed over the years. And are you thinking, you know, how are you thinking of your own approach to retirement? Yeah. Is that different from maybe what it was like 10 or 15 years ago?
Yeah, I realize what my privilege is, that I have a tenured job at a university that's financially stable. And I love my students, and I get grants to do work in this area. And so my retirement, I get to craft on my own. I can decide how much to work, how much not to work. And I am more dedicated now to say, I'm privileged. And so are you, Senator. And so are you, other big shot economist and financial manager. Actually, the financial managers have really high stress. You know, for all the people involved, the elite, you know, who make policy, I'm not going to retire because I have a message to them, which is that you're elite and your situation is not everybody else. So my personal plans is, I say it kind of glibly, as long as my knees and my mind hold up, I'm not going to retire until most other people can retire.
I love that. Thank you so much for your time. This has been such a fascinating conversation.
Thank you. I'm so glad to have this conversation. Thanks for your intelligent questions.
Thanks for listening to this week's Afterwards podcast. If you are interested in podcasts about nonfiction books, listen to C-SPAN's Book Notes Plus podcast for interviews with authors and historians hosted by Brian Lamb.